How's everything in Austin?
I've already sampled Franklin's barbecue, and I think I've done everything I need to do here. I'm good to go.
Yeah, just get around, go back to the airport, and hop on a plane, right?
Yeah.
I went to Austin 2 times, and I never did make it to Franklin's, so I will have to put that on my list to do.
Well, and I can't say, actually, I went and had to stand in line. I went to the super secret filmmakers lunch. It's sponsored by Dolby, and it's hosted by Robert Rodriguez out of his Troublemaker Studios. They put you all on a bus, and then they take you to a place that you don't know where you're going, and then you realize, we're actually going to his studio, because all it says is that it's in conjunction with Troublemaker.
Okay.
And then they catered it through Franklin's, which I was like, I've died and gone to heaven. We're good to go. And I got to meet Robert Rodriguez. So I was like, how do you meet a day like this?
I think that the South by Southwest Film Festival is off to a fantastic start. It's just going to bode well then for your film and everything to come after.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm delighted.
I'm sure that you're probably either digesting or then need to move on, so I won't take too terribly much time. It's probably nap time after that, right?
Yeah, well, of course, I had meetings after that, so I had to power through I'm in a meat coma, but it was worth it.
Absolutely. So, hey, I understand that you were raised around the D.C. area.
I was born in Paris, France. I have an older brother who was born in London because our father was a foreign correspondent at the time.
Okay.
For UPI. And then when my mother wanted to come back to the United States, my father got a job at the Washington Post. So we moved there when I was about 3. And I was there until I left to go to New York when I was, I think it was about 18.
Okay.
No, 19, I think.
Okay. And you went off to New York by yourself at the age of 19?
I did.
Wow.
And when I look back, if you could see a picture of me when I was 19, I literally look like I'm 12. No exaggeration. I think, who in their right mind would let their child go to New York on their own?
But you did.
Crazy dream. But I did. And my mother, you know, enormous credit to her for, I'm not saying it wasn't a nail biter for her, but she did let me go and see how it went. And I actually, in fairness, I did have a grandmother up there.
Okay.
But it was, so I had visited New York so many times, but it was very, very different to live there. And I have to say, kind of a culture shock. I was quite lonely. I didn't have a lot of friends. And then the people I was working with were usually quite a bit older than me because I was 19.
Right.
You know, and so all my colleagues were in college for the most part. And so I was in the professional world. And while I wouldn't trade it for anything, I don't think I had any idea how to navigate that sort of emotionally and socially
right.
when I was that age.
Is your mom still around, by the way?
Yeah, she still lives in D.C.
Do you ever ask her what she was thinking and what was going through her mind when you were off in New York? Do you have that discussion?
I have asked her. And my mother is, hindsight is seen through rose-colored glasses.
Right, right.
she will always say, well, I always knew you'd make your way. You were very independent and you had very definite ideas about what you wanted to do. So I don't think she's accounting for all the sleepless nights, of which I'm sure there were many.
I am sure. I have a daughter that's 22 and I still have sleepless nights. So
how could you not?
I know. You did live theater in New York. Is that right?
Yes, I loved it. And I got to New York and 6 weeks later, I was actually Cynthia Nixon's understudy.
Oh, wow.
On Broadway in the very first production of The Real Thing by Tom Stoppard that it was being directed by Mike Nichols and, you know, as Jeremy Irons and Glenn Close. And, of course, when I auditioned for the role to play Jeremy Irons' daughter, they didn't say it was for the understudy. And then I got the part and I was like, oh, no, I'm not doing that. Oh, no. Oh, heavens, no. And my agent was like, sit down and shut up. Yes, you are doing that. You will.
You had a very wise agent, yeah.
Yes. and learn something. And just, what is your deal?
It's Broadway, for God's sake.
For 5 weeks. And then by, you know, the tremendous good fortune that I had really for the first 10 years of my career, Mike Nichols ended up directing Hurley Burley by David Rabe, and he pulled Cynthia Nixon out of The Real Thing to put her in that, and I got to take over the role with the original cast.
Wow.
And that was a huge break for me. And I didn't know at the time that often understudies, they almost never take over a role.
Okay.
It's a very funny, you can actually make an entire career out of being an understudy if you are reliable and you're a good actor, then they'll hire you as that. You can actually get typecast and pegged as, oh, she's a great understudy.
Oh, wow.
If I had known that, I would have, I don't know what, like, thrown somebody under a bus. I don't know. Like, I would have been, was like, oh, no, I'm not. This is not happening. And so I really, really lucked out when they said, yes, you can take over the part.
Right. Either you lucked out or Cynthia Nixon did. I'm not sure which, you know?
I think she went on to do all right for herself.
I think she did okay. I was referring to the being thrown under the bus part.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she was lucky that I have not yet reached a homicidal peak at that point.
Cool. Good deal. Is there, like, looking back, it's always fun to look back at your younger self. Are there any words of advice that you would have given yourself at that time period?
Yes, I would. And I don't know that it would have worked, but certainly I would have said to my younger self, do not attach your value to your accomplishments. Try to remember and always work on the fact that you are valuable whether or not you got that job, whether or not you earned that reward, whether or not you got exit applause that night. You know, I very early on, and didn't realize I was doing it until I was a good 20 years into my career, I realized that I had tied my identity and my value to external things. Mm. And, of course, you can't fill up the inside from the outside.
Oh, so true.
Not
so
ever.
True. Yeah.
You know, not whether it's a relationship or a job or an award or anything. And the other thing that I think I didn't realize is that I think I had this idea that once I reached a certain level of achievement that I would be satisfied and I would sort of not rest on my laurels, but I would kind of cruise along after that, and nothing could have been further from the truth. If you are ambitious by nature and you thrive on setting the bar high and then trying to figure out how you're going to touch that bar, you will achieve things that you set out as a goal, and then you will immediately turn around and go, what's next?
Right, right.
And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think you just have to don't miss the moment when you actually achieve the thing you set out to do, mm-hmm. and try to create a balance so that, again, you don't tie your value to these external goals.
Right. I think those are great words of advice for a lot of people, maybe not even younger selves. I think those are great words to remind us all to have our own sense of worth and identity. And then now I believe, is All Square the first time you've produced? I know you've executive produced films, but is this time the first time that you've produced a film?
Let's see. I think, yes, I guess so. The first film I executive produced, it was a micro budget. It was like $50,000, and I ended up being in it as well, and it really was all hands on deck, so I was returning camera equipment when nobody else was available, and I was buying makeup supplies, and so everybody was doing everything, and
right.
I always really loved the spirit of that. All Square was a more formal arrangement, you know, they actually had people on the ground to do those things.
Right, right.
You have to sort of go, who's free? Who's done with their lunch? Okay.
Who's got gas in the car? Let's go.
Exactly. And I also we record The Simpsons all the way through the summer, and we shot this in Baltimore in the summer. And so I sort of stayed in Los Angeles for the most part and held the fort back at my company, Paperclip, that I have with Ben Cornwell, and then Ben, and then Jonathan Rosenthal and Jordan Foley, who are the other finance partners, and who were really boots on the ground, sort of did most of the heavy lifting with the rest of the crew.
Okay.
So I was the queen. I just sort of stayed above the fray. You see what I'm saying?
That's the way to be. Sit on that throne royally. That's right.
It's quite beautifully orchestrated.
Yeah, you know, when I was watching it, I didn't look to see where it was filmed, and I'm like, this looks like home to me. This looks like the DC area. It's got to be around there somewhere. And then I
thought,
yeah,
it was in Dundalk, which is outside of Baltimore.
And it looks like a quaint little town. I've not been to Dundalk. I've been to Annapolis and to Baltimore, but never to Dundalk.
It's modest. Like, I feel like it's hardworking,
right?
And they have a lot of community pride, which we loved, but they're not flashy about it,
right?
And I really respected that.
That's wonderful. Now, how did you come to know about this script, or did you help in develop the script? And I think it was a first time writer also for the screenplay.
Yes, so it actually came to us. My partner, Ben, and I went to a Television Academy event about 2.5 years ago now, I guess, 2 years ago, and Michael Kelly was there, and I'd never met him, and of course I'm a huge fan.
Sure.
Because who isn't? And so I just went charging up to him and completely ambushed him and said, hi, Michael, hi, I'm Dorothy Smith, and I do the voice of Lisa Simpson, and I just think you're incredible, and I really wanted to meet you, and he couldn't have been more gracious or lovely, kind or welcoming. And so we exchanged information, and we were in touch a little bit over the next year, and then he sent us an email one day and said, listen, I have this script. I really want to do it. I know the writer. We already have a director. We have half the money. I don't know if you guys would be interested. So Ben and I read it, and not even kidding, a week later, we said, we're in, and we were in pre-production.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. And then casting right immediately after that?
Yes. And it all came together quite quickly, which is remarkable always in film.
Right.
I think you can kind of and part of that was, so we had a 3-week production schedule, shooting schedule, and if you can say to somebody like Pamela Adlon, you know, we only need you for 4 days and we'll shoot you out,
uh-huh,
then that's much more workable than saying our schedule is 3 weeks long, can you come down and hang out for 3 weeks,
right,
even though we only might need you for 4 or 5 days,
right?
So we really worked overtime to make it user-friendly for all of these actors who work a lot and are incredibly busy, like Harris and, you know, Isaiah Whitlock and like that, and Pamela. You know, one of the things about Paperclip that Ben and I are proud of, or that we like about our company, is that because we do have a budget, we are able to say yes first. You know, we like to take projects across all mediums, mm-hmm, and develop them at their earliest stages. That's our motto. And because we have a budget, we can pay that WGA writer that we think is really terrific. We can pay them what they deserve, and they'll write a script for us.
Okay.
You know, we don't have to say, you have to write it on script, and then we'll take it out and let's see what happens.
Right.
And so it allows us to move the needle more quickly than things usually happen in our business.
Right. That's fantastic. Your company, Paperclip, that's a production company?
We call it a development company because,
okay,
we're not, like Jordan Foley and Jonathan Rosenberg really are a production company.
Okay.
They know literally about line producing. They love to get there and get, you know, into the mud up their knees and stuff like that. And I love more the creative process, mm-hmm, of most everything. And Ben is a great behind the scenes guy. So we're a really good team that way.
How long has Paperclip been around?
We're coming up on 3 years this summer.
Okay.
So not very long, and we've actually made tremendous progress. We have quite a variety of projects on our board. We actually have a true crime podcast, if you're a true crime fan.
Oh, yeah. My daughter loves those, too. What is it called?
Pam, it's called Small Town Dicks.
Okay.
And you can get it on iTunes and Stitcher and everywhere. It is so good. I co-host it with my best friend and these two identical twin detectives. So all of the cases are told by the detectives who investigated the case. And we have, 911 calls and suspect interviews, and we're blowing up. We're only in season two. We launched last fall, and we already have 240,000 downloads. So we're pretty happy about ourselves.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. And I can't wait to shoot that text to my daughter after I get off the phone with you.
And there's a funny joke, and we have a Facebook page, of course, and Twitter and Instagram, but on the Facebook page, there was a great discussion about if you are a fan of the Grateful Dead, you're called a deadhead. So if you're a fan of Small Town Dicks, are you, it can't be that.
It's good. I'm going to use it.
But it's really terrific. We also have an animated series that we're pitching around town where the art is beautiful. And to what I was saying earlier, because we do have this budget, we were able to hire an artist whose work is exquisite and hire a writer to write the pilot. And when you bring things that are some studios don't like it, but if you bring to a network things that are pretty well fleshed out nowadays,
right,
I think you have a much greater chance of getting something made.
Well, and it sounds like that's a great way to set a model to get better films made, more films made, and tap into those independent gems that may not have been made otherwise.
Absolutely right. Who knows how long it would have taken to... I think Timothy Brady had written this script a while ago, and then he sort of brought it out and dusted it off. I think this is true. And then showed it to Michael, and they're great friends. And Michael's like, well, fuck, I want to do this. And Michael doesn't get to do a lot of comedies. And as you know, it's a dark comedy. And so it was just ripe for the picking and for everybody.
Right. Did you come across any challenges as being the producer, sitting on your throne, as you say, as the queen, in doing this? Because it was still just a 3-week shoot, whether or not you were shooting people in and out during that time period. Were there any challenges that were difficult, or maybe some happy accidents that happened and made it into the film?
There are always challenges when you're asking people to work for scale. We, by the grace of God and Michael Kelly, we had a lot of the House of Cards crew as our crew, and you cannot overvalue what having all these people who work together, it was such a well-oiled machine. It made that job of having to do 7 pages a day kind of thing so made it doable,
right?
Because otherwise, it's already such a challenge when you're moving that fast, but if you have people who can sort of anticipate what your next move is as their team member, it makes it exponentially it makes it more fun. It also makes it more doable,
right?
For me, and you're asking them, their second meal is Jerry Subs, which everybody was super excited about for like the first week, and then they're like, oh god. But we're on the shoestring budget.
Right.
You still have to feed them.
Yeah.
And the parameters are pretty vague as long as it's edible. And those are good sandwiches. But I always feel badly as a person who likes to, when I throw a party, I like to really take care of my guests, or if you're a guest at my house. I wish that I could have provided a hot meal from the best restaurant in town, but the budget just didn't seem to allow for it. I think one of the happy accidents was we had a co-producer named Nicholas Smith, who had the Midas touch when it came to getting companies to give us things for free. So a lot of it takes place in a bar, and we were able to feature Sagamore Spirits. And now Sagamore is a Baltimore company.
Right.
So they were eager, I think, to be a part of a production that was in their hometown. But I just never expect anybody to give you anything for free.
Right.
And Nick had a knack. Like, we got all those sandwiches for free.
Wow.
You know, and we, for just for the special thanks at the end credits. And we got Sagamore Spirits. We got the ability to use some signage. But, you know, you have to go pretty far up the food chain to get people to sign off on this stuff. And
right.
It was incredibly gracious. Those, to me, are the little miracles that you can just cross that off your list, and then you can deal with the next big thing that you haven't actually anticipated.
Right, right. Well, and that just kind of reminds you of the goodness of people's hearts, too, when they do
yes.
that kind of thing, you know?
Absolutely.
Now, you have a small part in this film.
I do. And I had to pay to play, Pam.
And you did well. I loved your role. Did you have your pick of which one you wanted to do, or was that like
no?
No.
And then when they said, "Yardley, we think you should play Beaches, the bartender," I was like, "Really?" Because I think that I feel like she's sort of much older and less curated, maybe a little plumper.
Right, right.
Yeah, a little more bedraggled than uh-huh. the way I usually present myself on a day-to-day. Like, oh, no, you can do it. Like, Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for nothing. But I was... And I guess my misgiving was I didn't at all want it to seem like, oh, we had to put the executive producer in the movie. I didn't want to be the thing that stuck out like a sore thumb who didn't belong in this world. I think when I saw it, I was actually quite pleased, and I think I had four lines, and now it's down to two, and that's that's probably best. But I get it. I take the note. try not to take it personally. But it was, so for me, it wasn't a slam dunk, and I didn't beg them. I just really wanted to be. I didn't want to impugn the integrity of the film.
Right.
It was great fun to do a scene with, to do scenes with Michael Kelly. That was intimidating for sure.
Was it really?
Yeah, and then you get to know him, and he's really the funniest, warmest, phenomenally generous actor. There are actors who you can do a scene with them, and they're looking at you, but they're looking through you.
Right.
And Michael really connects with you and sort of looks right into your soul, which can be incredibly unnerving, but I would rather have that than the dude who doesn't even notice that you're in front of them.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he is quite the talented actor. I loved seeing him in this role, very different role for him, and that was a lot of
yes.
fun. You've also got, you've written a children's book, is that right?
I did. I wrote a children's book that was published in 2009 through HarperCollins. And it actually goes back to what I was saying about how you shouldn't tie your identity to your job. And I was sort of going through this existential crisis where I wasn't getting as much work for a long time. I stopped getting work sort of in my mid 30s, like a lot of television work,
okay.
and which was my bread and butter. I still had The Simpsons, thank God.
Right.
It was the best job in the world. But I stopped getting on camera work, and I really couldn't make sense of it. And I didn't sort of flail around for a year. I flailed around for close to a decade going, what's wrong, and what am I doing wrong, and why is this happening? And I would say the downside of having so much success at such an early age is that you end up not having to build a foundation. So I was sort of liken it to having built a house without any foundation at the base of it. And so I wouldn't say opportunities were given to me, but that's not true. Opportunities were given to me, and I was able to make the most of them.
Right.
But because I didn't ever have a real job, like I never had to waitress, I didn't have to do any of those other things, I didn't have to sort of slog and or create work for myself in a way that so many of my colleagues had.
Right.
And that really was a massive disservice when, as the times changed, you had to become this multi-hyphenate, even if you didn't want to.
Right.
So you couldn't just be an actor anymore. You had to be actor, writer, producer, actor, whatever, whatever. And I was like, why can't I just be an actor anymore?
Right.
Like, well, you can, but you're not famous enough to just get acting work, so you better figure it out. And at that time, when I was writing the book, I had had an agent for a very long time, 22 years, and I still had The Simpsons, obviously, and I wasn't getting any work, and I was really frustrated and quite depressed about it, so I fired my agent, and then nobody would take me.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, if I wasn't going to just pony up Simpsons dough, they were like, yeah, I don't know, Yardley. I mean, you haven't done anything for a while. I'm like, I know. That's why I need you. Like, well, and it's really interesting phenomenon and difficult to find somebody who's willing to make the call and not just take the call.
Okay.
So I didn't have an agent for about a year and a half. And in that time, because I needed to create something so it didn't feel like a total waste of food, I took this creative writing class. And I ended up writing these little vignettes about this girl named Lorelai, who was 11 years old, who had a really funny, very dry, slightly off-center view of the world. And ultimately, I sort of tied them all together. And in the course of this class, I wrote this book and I sold it to HarperCollins so fast, like in a week. Which was good and bad because, of course, it was reminiscent of the beginning of my acting career. I'm like, oh, no, this is going to happen again, isn't it? And I'm going to flail around and go, fuck, what happened? Ah, now I don't know what to do. Well, cut to a year later when they actually released the book, which I still think is a really wonderful book. And it was quite beautifully reviewed. It was really well received, but they didn't put any marketing behind it. And so it was a commercial failure, but it's still a really good book. I still really love it. She's a great girl, that Lorelai.
I am looking for, I will be purchasing it and taking a look. So I'm looking forward to that. And then
you
have a one woman show that you do called More as well.
I did. Do is the wrong tense.
Okay.
I did it and I'll never do it again.
Why not?
That was sort of my, you know, it was, interestingly, it was also sort of around that time where I thought, okay, I better pull up my socks and I'll create work for myself somehow. I don't know how to do this, but I'll write this one-woman show. And for me, it was a cautionary tale, again, about don't try to fill up the inside from the outside the way I did, because you'll miss so many fantastic things along the way.
Right.
And it'll be so painful because you'll look back on the last 10 years and go, what have I done?
Right.
And you won't be able to A, remember, or B, feel the satisfaction of any of those achievements. So I put it all in a one-woman show. It was directed by Judith Ivey, who's a Tony Award-winning actress and so brilliant and smart and funny. And I did it in New York and LA. And sadly, the New York Times reviewed it like a review like your mother would write, where she said every girl in America should see this show, but pretty much everybody else disliked it. I think it was terribly misunderstood, where people thought, you have everything, I don't know why I should feel sorry for you. And I'm like, oh my God, you've missed the point.
Oh, man.
That's what I'm telling you.
Right.
I have everything, and how come it didn't work?
Right?
How come all of that material wealth and all of those opportunities didn't make me feel like whatever I felt was broken inside of me is now fixed? And
nobody
most people didn't get that. The audiences really loved it, but it was, because it was not well reviewed, of course, we couldn't fill the houses and we had to close sooner than anybody wanted to. But
can you tell me, and I'll just ask one more question, then I'll let you go. I really do appreciate all of your insight and everything. With everything that's happened with women in Hollywood today, can you tell me a little bit about your thoughts, your experiences, and your hopes for our future in not just filmmaking, but to the world?
Yes. Well, I've certainly had my own Me Too experiences. Very, very early on, I remember, long before I had an agent, but I graduated from high school and I was doing a play at Arena Stage, and one of the women who worked on the crew took me up to Originally, I thought it was New York, but it ended up being Newark, New Jersey, which is not New York.
No, it's not.
To see this guy who was supposedly a Paramount Studios executive. And we go to this, I mean, this fucking skanky office. It was pretty scary. And I remember him saying to this woman who had brought me with him, you wait in my office, which was this shitty little dirty room with a desk in it, and Yardley and I will come in here and work on some scenes. And so he had a bunch of copy from commercials that you'd already seen on TV, and I started reading it. And then by the second one, he said, okay, I'm not just going to read with you. You're going to play the wife and I'm going to play the husband. I'm like, okay. And it was, I remember it was a perfume commercial.
Okay.
And they're supposed to get close to each other, and he comes over to me, and then he starts to try to kiss me. And I remember being so startled, right, and so scared and disgusted, and I turned my cheek, and he said, well, if you're going to do that, this isn't going to work.
Oh, my God.
And then he said, do you have a boyfriend? And I lied and said, no, that I didn't. And he said, well, that's good, because if you did, I would ask you to leave right now.
Oh, my God.
And I never told anybody about it. Now, it's certainly not, you know, my God, the things that some of the men we've heard about have,
right,
done to women, where, oh, Harvey Weinstein, don't, I mean, where do you even start?
Right.
But I think... And then there were other things that are, again, much subtler. And then there's also the sexism that you just encounter during the day. And that, for me, was one of the trickiest issues, even now, because if you report to your male counterparts, I really feel there was so, that they were just blowing me off, that there was so much sexism in this movie, in this meeting.
Uh-huh.
Chances are, my experience anyway is like, Shirley, you're crazy. They love you. That's ridiculous. And it's dismissed out of hand. And so then you start to think, oh, it must be me. I must be crazy.
Right.
And so while I do believe in due process, of course, my hope is that at least there will always be room from either side for the conversation to be had. I think it's a really delicate dance, because everybody has a different comfort level.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, I guess all you can ask of somebody is to be respectful. And if you say to someone, that makes me really uncomfortable, even if you don't think it's a big deal, you go, oh, I'm so sorry about that.
Right.
That's not my intention. I won't do that anymore.
Right.
As opposed to either shaming them or telling them that they're imagining things, or somehow discounting their experience.
Right.
And then, of course, I mean, the stories you hear out of places like Silicon Valley and stuff.
Yeah.
I just don't understand. What is that innate of? Don't you want all the best minds working toward the same goal?
That would be my thought and common sense, but apparently that doesn't exist. You
it
know?
Doesn't exist. And I really don't understand that, because where I sit, you know, now as even when I had my shoe company, I had a shoe line for 5 years. We made the shoes out of Italy, and I would go to Italy twice a year, and I'd go into the factories and go to the tanneries and pick my materials and correct the samples. But I was never the smartest person in the room. I absolutely relied on and enjoyed relying on people who knew more about me in whatever department they had been hired,
right,
to manage. And it's the same with Paperclip, you know, and collaborating with Milhouse, with Jonathan and Jordan. I'm like, you guys have your wheelhouse and I have mine.
Right.
And hopefully, you know, we find a place to meet in the middle. But that's what's exciting to me. What do you bring to the table?
Right.
Because your point of view is so different, and I don't really care if you're a man or a woman.
Right.
I don't understand why, you know, to me, always, if you're lording your power over somebody for whatever reason, then that speaks to some deep insecurity on your behalf and has nothing to do with the other person.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we've got a long, long road ahead of us.
People don't like to feel blamed, and their first reaction is usually defense, and
right.
They turn it back on you. And that's, if you're 22, but yeah, I'm 53, even if you're 53, it's a really uncomfortable place to be. And I think as women, two things we do really well, we apologize needlessly for almost everything.
Don't we, though? Yeah.
Yes, which includes taking on your vitriol, right?
Right.
Like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry I made you feel that way, when... In fact, you are the one, we as the women were like, listen, that makes me really uncomfortable. And now you're having to apologize for the way that you feel.
Right.
It's so tricky. And we're so enculturated that way, I think, we're empathic,
right.
And we blame ourselves.
Right. And I think that's how we have been raised, too. I'm also
totally.
53. And,
yes.
You know, I still find myself in different situations where, in hindsight, why didn't I say this? Why didn't I handle
yes.
it this way? You know? So
it's agony.
It is.
It is.
It is.
Worst.
So
I wish that somebody had coached me as well to literally practice in front of the mirror various responses, so that when you are in a high stress situation like that and you do feel emotional, you're like, oh yeah, and you can hearken back to that
right.
thing. It's like a learned behavior, right?
Exactly. So I wish somebody would have told me that too. And because I'm still learning how to deal with stuff too. You know, well, hopefully the next generation and the generation after that will have it down pat and not have to deal with these kind of issues.
I hope so. But I'm afraid as long as we're human and we're flawed, there will always be somebody who isn't happy for you when you do well.
I know. We can just try within ourselves and then see
yes.
what happens from there, you know?
Totally.
Well, Yardley, I will let you go. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed talking, chatting with you.
Oh, me too, Pam.
And
thank you.
Best of luck. You won't need it, but best of luck down in Austin. And make sure you get one more different type of barbecue while you're down there. And definitely try the food trucks. They're amazing.
Oh, excellent. I am so doing that. I actually think I might have the night off tonight.
Ooh, cool.
So, tomorrow's a big, big day. So I think I might go track down some more Q.
Awesome. Enjoy that Q, and thanks for
Thank
this
you.
Q&A.
Likewise.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.